fail.
All right. The Academic Affairs Committee has several items for our discussion and presentation. Also, some exciting news. And the first on the deck is the Master of Fine Arts degree type. Provost,
you're in here somewhere.
To your left.
You read your note?
Sorry. To introduce,
briefly, like to make a few remarks before we get in the agenda, if I could, please. If you noticed the press release that went out earlier this week, we've successfully recruited and appointed a new dean for our College of Health and Human Services, Dr. Neil Chumbler, who comes to us from the University of Georgia. He's department head of the Health and Policy Management Department. He got a very impressive resume in teaching, research, and leadership roles, and also impressed everyone during his interview with a kind of clear vision that he has for moving the college forward. More than that, though, I want to point out that Neil's an extraordinary fit for WKU. He's not only a graduate of this institution, he was the 1991 Graduate Student of the Year from WKU. His wife is a graduate of WKU, double graduate, I understand. And we're looking forward to Neil. He will start in mid-March of next year. I want to pay a few remarks about John Barnaguro, who will be stepping down from the dean position at that same time. John was founding dean of the college for over 12 years. You may have heard John remark on more than one occasion that it's the largest college at WKU, and that is indeed a true statement. But also has seen very impressive growth over the last few years, including the health science complex near the medical center, a doubling of the number of slots we have in our BSN program, and two doctoral programs that have now, starting to produce graduates. So, again, I do have copies of the press release here. If you haven't seen it, you're welcome to pick one up at the end. Thank you.
Very good.
With that, Regent Bale, thank you. Our first agenda item is a request for approval of a Master of Fine Arts degree type. This is a new degree type for WKU. It's a master's degree, but in many fields is the terminal degree. And we're requesting additional approval of a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing program. This will be, unlike many MFA programs, which are called low residency. This will be a full residency program. Students will be, will enter under, full graduate assistantships and will help in the teaching mission throughout the two-year duration of the program. The program primarily prepares students for lives as writers of novels, short fiction, creative nonfiction, scripts, and poetry. It is a 48-credit-hour program, and we intend to implement in the fall of 2015. The gentlemen in the front row there, Rob Hale and David Bell and Tom Hundley, which of you gentlemen would care to say a few more words about the program?
Okay. Thanks for welcoming us. I'm Rob Hale, I'm the head of the English department, and we put together what we think is an exciting program. It's even more exciting than the audit report, I think. Sorry. We think this program will prepare students for lives as writers, but also gives them complementary career preparation by the time they graduate, so that they can hone their craft while they're in the room. The two-year residential program is 48 hours graduate coursework. It culminates in rigorous comprehensive exams and completion of a publishable creative thesis in fiction, poetry, script writing, or creative nonfiction. I could go through all the details, but I thought I would just sort of highlight five distinctives of the program. We'll be one of two public residential interfaith programs in the state. And we think we'll be the only comprehensive residential program in the state. We require more hours because of our professional interest than the UK does. Our program also has three secondary emphases. Students can get a secondary emphasis in composition and rhetoric, literature, and teaching English as a second language. We think that will lead to more career opportunities. They're also required to do two internships while they're in the program, so they need some real-world experience before getting out into the workplace. As Gordon mentioned, all of our students are funded. To get their funding, they're going to teach four classes for us as part of their program. We're going to train them extensively. We already have a one-time program for our graduate assistants, so they'll participate in that. A bonus that they'll get is some exposure to creative writing pedagogy. Tom Hunley has two books on creative writing pedagogy. One is just about to come out next semester, and so we're excited about that potential as well. The fourth distinctive is script writing. As you probably know, we have a growing film undergraduate program at the university. It's just growing by leaps and bounds. We decided to put script writing into the mix. There are any other MFA programs in the state that have script writing. We think we can leverage some connections and internships down in Nashville and the growing film industry down there. And then the last distinctive is we hope to have an international component for our program. I visited the University of East Anglia this summer there in the early stages of starting an MFA program over there. University of East Anglia has one of the best creative writing programs in the UK, so it could be a real opportunity if we can make that happen. So that's what I've got. Maybe you add a few words? Or?
The only thing I might add to that just a little bit is that this MFA in creative writing is an extension of the strength the university already has in the arts across the discipline. You may have seen a recent Courier Journal article that talks about creativity as a growth industry in Kentucky right now, and modern college programs play a really significant part of that. There are, across the country, only 30 universities that can say they have nationally accredited programs in art, music, theater, dance. And I'm proud to be able to say that WKU is one of those 30 universities nationally that can say that. Part of what we're doing here is transitioning that strength at the undergraduate level to the graduate level. We recently started the new Masters of Music, which takes much better advantage of the strength of our music program. This MFA builds on the well-established existing strength of the English department. So this is not a kind of single growth thing. It is part of a comprehensive effort in the arts, across Potter College, and it plugs into some very important things that are happening in Kentucky right now.
I might add that an MFA is considered a terminal degree, and that's kind of immaterial to why we're doing it, but it is a footnote that I think is of some consequence as we look at our portfolio of terminal degrees within the institution.
Anyone have any questions?
I agree, it's exciting.
I do.
Okay.
First of all, I compliment you. I think it's exciting to have the MFA, and I know you're building on strength, and I really don't have any question about the quality or design of the program. I do have a question, though, just wondering whether the funding that you've requested will assure affordability for students and sustainability of the program. You're targeting roughly 6 students a year, so 12 or 13 students at any one time. You noted that maybe a couple of them could pay their own way, and the numbers do show that the funds generated will support the program. You're requesting one FTE. When I look at the tuition, or were you intending, I guess is my question, were you intending that the $10,000 a year stipend for students, first year and $13,000 second year, be all the student gets, or do they get tuition waivers as well?
They get tuition waivers as well.
Okay.
They're really committed to making this program affordable because there are 2 million MFA programs out there that exploit students. And that's one of the first things we said when we started this.
I just wanted to clarify that. So you really, in saying that it's a wash on cost, that is students. Students will get tuition waiver as well as stipend. I think that's really going to be important in getting people who can afford to be residential. So I'm pleased about that.
That would suggest a high standard for acceptance.
Yes, sir.
And those tuition waivers, Regent Birch, also came out of the staffing plan. They do not impact the availability of tuition waivers for students in other programs.
Okay.
These are add-ons to the existing tuition waiver budget in the graduate school.
I think the practical nature of adding in there that their employability will be enhanced by some other things was very good too. You'd like to think they'd all make a living right out of the business. Very good. Any other comments or questions? It's great. Look forward to reading some good stuff. And I bet that the applications will have some interesting items that you're evaluating them on for acceptance. Okay. Mr. Provost?
Do you want to move on? Take a motion on that?
For approval of a Master of Fine Arts degree.
So moved.
Second? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion passes. Very good. Great.
Okay, thank you. Our next agenda item is requesting approval for a Master of Arts in Education degree in Gifted Education Talent Development. Gifted children have constituted a category of exceptional students in Kentucky since the passage of the Kentucky Education Reform Act in 1990. And of course, with our Center for Gifted Studies and Gatton Academy, WKU excels in this area. The National Science Foundation report in 2010 stated that to reach true equality of opportunity and to ensure that potential does not go unrealized, we must not overlook the educational needs of our nation's most talented and motivated students. The MAE in Gifted Education and Talent Development will enhance advanced learning opportunities for teachers of those gifted students by offering additional graduate work in this area of specialization. And to say a few words of this program, someone who probably needs no introduction to this group, Dr. Julia Roberts.
One will be for advanced teacher certification for teacher leaders, and that's a required program. This will be a way that teachers can pursue their master's certification that's required. A second pathway is for advanced research, and we think that people who will come to EDUCAU to pursue that area in education, just because we've been doing so much here for so long. We have offered the gifted endorsement in Kentucky since 1984, and we're the only institution that has done that annually. Other institutions in Kentucky do offer the endorsement, but no other institution offers advanced work in gifted education. And it seems to us that this ought to be the place that people would want to come to pursue that level of education. Do you have questions? I've got a lot of information on it, but I'm not sure how much you want to know.
Why did it take so long?
Well, I don't know. There are a lot of things that kind of pop up as barriers along the way. But the process of getting to this has been slowed down by the various institutions that have to approve it. We send it out and think it will be no time, and it takes months. So we're eager to move this forward.
Julia, this is a clarification. I certainly think that there's going to be a master's in this area. I can't imagine what else it should be. Is the notation that the existing program, the phase down in 2012, does that mean that's a good thing for this? Or?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Somewhere in talking about resources, you indicated that there was a phase out of a program in 2012.
I don't know about any phase out.
All right, so this
is adding on to what we're currently doing. Nothing has changed with the state certification. It stays the same as it has since 1984.
It looked like you're going to be joining some good company with some of the other national universities.
We think we are in good company with national universities. Other universities that offer services such as we do through the Center for Gifted Studies would be names you would all recognize.
Anyone have any other questions to ask Julia, or is anybody intimidated because of her great internet?
Well,
we do recognize all the work you've done for years, and the fact that you are internationally recognized, and feel fortunate to have you on campus.
Will this be directly tied to our Center for Gifted Studies or an indirect connection?
It's indirect to the Center for Gifted Studies. The center, as Ann talked about, is one of the revenue-producing units here. The only thing we get from the university is my salary. Beyond that, we generate our own.
With your summer programs and other year-long programs.
But
your summer programs and other SCADS, VAMP Eves, Super Saturdays, et cetera, will certainly provide learning platforms for students in this program, I would
Absolutely.
Presume.
Absolutely. Practicum.
Yeah.
It's always offered to that program. That's why we started it. We started summer programming to have a practicum. Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, do I hear a motion for approval of the Masters of Arts in Education, Gifted Education, and Talent Development?
So moved.
Motion and second. Dr. Dennison, any discussion? Get you next time, Nathan.
Yeah.
All in favor say aye. Opposed, like sign. Motion passes. Mr. Provost.
Our third item is a request for approval of a Bachelor of Science degree in Special Education Learning and Behavioral Disorders in Elementary Education. With some 6.5 million special education students in the United States, the need for special education teachers is expected to grow by almost 20% between now and 2020. The proposed program will replace the current program in Exceptional Education Learning Behavior Disorders and Moderate Severe Disabilities by eliminating the Moderate Severe Disabilities component and adding the Elementary Education component. The total program is more efficient. It's now down to 91 program hours. And Dr. Dusty Knotts is here to say a few more words. Dusty.
Thank you for having me. We're very excited to present this program. A lot of times when you say special education, the first thing you think of is a child in a wheelchair or a child more severely disabled. But the reality is, of that 6.5 million children, over 80% of them have at least average or above average intelligence. And they will be trained in the general education curriculum. And they'll be in the general education classroom. So one of the things that we started looking at this program 4.5 years ago under Dr. Adler, and looking at what are the skills that we really need to give our special ed teachers. And what it came to us over and over is collaboration, inclusion, working with other teachers, and that type of thing. We're driven by a number of federal mandates, No Child Left Behind. Our current program gives our special education teachers very highly qualified in special ed, but not in a content area. So as we looked at that, we started discussion with our elementary faculty, and we asked about, what do you think about putting these two together? And so these are both existing programs. As a matter of fact, out of the 91 hours, only 24 hours of these are new, which is on the special ed side where we could really work with this. There are 4 other universities in the state that do dual certification. But one of the things that they don't do, as I speak to them, is they don't really start the collegiality of collaboration at the college level. They keep their programs separate and they tell their students to go out and co-teach. One of the things that we're really excited about, and we feel like we'll be leading the way, is this would be the only program that I have found in Kentucky where the collaboration would start at the collegial level. We'll be working with the elementary faculty, and we'll be co-teaching a lot of the courses as we speak to them. So is this needed? Well, we've asked Breck, to send out a little bitty survey to their special ed directors. And of the special ed directors, 21 of them said this would make a huge difference if they were hiring someone that had this dual certification, that it would make a big difference. Then they asked our students that are currently enrolled. And out of the 239 students, 186 of them said, we are very interested in this program. I wish we'd had it before I became a junior. So we know it's important. So is it important to teaching in general? Well, we do a TEL survey every year. And of that, we survey our student teachers, our interns, our collaborating teachers, and the principals, and say, what are the areas that you feel like you wanted better skills in? The top four areas will be covered in this program. So I really feel like for WKU, we will be, you know, we talk about education as a moving target right now. It's really hard to pitch. But what the faculty would like to have the opportunity is to get a little bit ahead of that target and be a leader instead of a follower in what's going on. Any questions?
Similar question to Dr. Roberts. So with the Vitale Clinical Education Complex engaged in a number of programs that are not unrelated to what this degree program is about, does that give you a practicum opportunity, an engagement with the programs, particularly the Kelly Autism Program, perhaps others?
Absolutely.
With the Vitale Clinical Education Complex?
The Kelly Autism Center is one of only a handful in the United States where we have those type of opportunities available. Plus the partnerships that we're working with our huge STEP grant, we're really developing a lot of partnerships throughout. We have the Buddy House here on campus, which has been a big help as well.
Any other questions, comments? Good, passionate presentation. Thank you.
It's kind of exciting.
I'm going to briefly ask Janet Applin to stand. It's Janet, the Career Wellness Program Associate Assistant Dean of the College. So, Janet,
all right.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Any other questions, discussion, or ask a call for a motion for approval of the Bachelor of Science in Special Education, Learning, and Behavioral Disorders in Elementary Education? Nikki, motion, get the second.
I got it.
All right, any further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, likewise. Okay, motion passes. Got to try to match their passion, y'all. Very good. My wife is a special education teacher, and she appreciated that presentation. All right, Mr. Provost.
Sir, fourth action item, a request to approve an undergraduate minor in psychological science. If you recall, about a year or so ago, the board approved the creation of a new department of psychological sciences in the Ogden College of Science and Engineering. That department has a bachelor's program and a master's program. There's now requesting to add a minor with 19 credit hours. And the minor will be particularly valuable to those students who are in pre-med or pre-health programs that require completion of the Medical College Admissions Test, or MCAT. Department head Kelly Madol. She will say a few more words. Kelly.
Thank you. As Dr. Emsley noted, our major in psychological sciences was approved in April. I'm suspected that about 80 majors that we have programs. But a number of faculty and students in other programs have asked us about minor programs, reference to minor programs. Like Dr. Emsley said, one of the major sources of interest is pre-med students who are usually majoring in chemistry, biology, and other disciplines. But because of the change in MCAT, MCAT has changed to reflect the fact that healthcare practitioners will now be expected much better grounding in psychological and sociocultural processes. So the MCAT reflects that, and the students probably will not be adequately prepared without taking more courses in disciplines of psychological sciences. So this minor, I think, will be particularly attractive to those students. But we've also had interest from other disciplines as well. So, for example, computer science students have expressed interest in minors in psychological sciences. And I think you can see where there would be an interesting interface between computer science and psychological sciences. And we've had interest from students in humanities and religious studies, for example, even in music. We have students who are in the double major, but some students might have some minor psychological sciences. So I think that it will be a really nice complement to students in a variety of disciplines. I think it will provide them some basic quantitative skills, more if they choose to take more quantitative courses, and then just a basic grounding and understanding of human behavior and psychological sciences. So I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Glad to hear 80 majors. It bodes well for the transition that's now been completed.
And that represents more than the two programs combined represent more majors than the individual. So it's not just a metal transformation.
I think it's a good thing that you're going to find some alternative ways of getting students into your courses. I just have one clarification. The most of the courses that are in this knowledge are different from the existing psychology knowledge.
Yes.
Right? Are they dualistic courses?
There are some. So there are some courses that are equivalent courses, but we have about 18 courses that are only courses that are offered in psychological sciences that would not be part of psychology minors.
I think it's a good thing that the MCAT is finally recognizing that that might be important. Any other questions, discussion? All right, thank you. I will call for a motion for approval of minor in psychological science. I'll take Cheryl's motion, Dr. Dennison's second. Further discussion? If not, all those say aye. Opposed. Motion passes. We have some sabbatical leaves.
Every year we receive a number of applications for faculty to conduct sabbatical leaves for either one semester or a full academic year. This year we have 14 requests for sabbatical leave, adding up to 18 semesters. Faculty use these leaves for professional development, enrichment, refreshment to some extent. They come back very refreshed. And I must add, they have been presenting some very impressive reports. They're required to present a report to my office at the end. I collect these reports, and they represent a very impressive array of activities and professional development for these faculty. So I here request approval of sabbatical leaves as listed in the packet.
Any discussion, questions about any of these?
No concern. Just curious. Were you able, I appreciate the fact you're able to increase the number of sabbaticals. Were you able to accommodate most of them that you had hoped you could, or are we still?
Yes. Most sabbaticals were approved. The only one I looked at was David Bell, actually, but he will be here to start the MFA in the fall. Sabbaticals approved for the spring. But yes, I don't know the exact percentage. I can get that for you, but it's most are approved.
And it's interesting that only three colleges are involved. Is there a cycle, or it just turned out that way?
It just turned out that this year. That's not usual. Just these are there were no applications from the other three colleges.
Okay. I have a motion for approval of the sabbaticals as listed. You hear a second? Okay. Second from Nikki. Any other discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Like sign. Motion passes. And we have some emeritus.
We do. Yes. We have a request to approve emeritus or emeritus status for four individuals. And I'll give brief resumes, and Regent Birch may wish to expand upon that at the full board meeting in January. First is Dr. Donald Nims, a professor of counseling and student affairs. And Dr. Nims was highly productive in all three areas of teaching, research, and service, and also provided leadership for the department as interim head. Notably, provided pro bono therapeutic services in the community medical clinic, supervised counselors working toward licensure as marriage and family therapists, and also supervised individuals seeking certifications as registered play therapists. And Dr. Janice Ferguson, the professor in the School of Teacher Education. For Dr. Ferguson, students always came first. She was the advisor for the student chapter of the Council for Exceptional Children. Also receiving the College of Education Behavioral Sciences Faculty Excellence Awards in both teaching and advising. Her graduates continue to provide outstanding comments about the impact she has had on their careers. Mr. James Letourneau, an assistant professor in the Journalism and Broadcasting Department, brought nearly two decades of professional experience with him when he joined the faculty in 2000. Using his career-based insights, he worked extensively with the student newscast, teaching students the nuts and bolts of fixing glitches of getting a show on the air and on time. Also recognized the importance of international experiences for broadcasting students, creating several opportunities for students in Italy. And Dr. Edward Wolfe, professor of finance, who served in the faculty in the Gordon Ford College of Business for three decades, during which time he distinguished himself as an outstanding teacher, leader, and educational innovator in his chosen field of financial planning. And indeed, Dr. Wolfe's vision for the creation of a financial planning program that has taken form for the recently approved Center for Financial Success that engages students, faculty, and the public in the important aspects of personal financial management. I'm pleased to present these four individuals to you for approval as emeritus faculty members.
Any discussion concerning these, and we will, I'm sure, have some comments to be made at the full board meeting in January. Nothing to say today. Entertain a motion. Motion, Dr. Denison, second. Richard Birch. Any other discussion? Not all those in favor, say aye. Opposed, like sign. Motion passes. All right. Mr. Provost, you have some information items.
I have two information items of a fairly varied nature, I think you'll find. First, you may have noticed a small army of people arriving in the room prior to the previous couple of agenda items that are here to be recognized for their services toward the preparation of our SAC COC off-site committee report. As noted in the Herald, it says WKU seeks reaccreditation, the decision to come next December. It's a year-long process, but we just got started. Every 10 years, each university in the southern region must submit a request for reaffirmation of accreditation by the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges, or SACS COC. I'm sorry, Rich, I'd like you to join me up here if you could. Other than the obvious seal of quality that accreditation provides, a university must be regionally accredited for students to be eligible for federal financial aid, which I think you'll agree is important. There are three stages in the reaffirmation process: an off-site review of a compliance certification website, which was submitted in September of this year and reviewed in November. Second stage is an on-site team visit, in which the team reviews any compliance issues noted earlier and also reviews the institution's quality enhancement plan. And last is the commission review at the annual meeting of SAC COC, will be next December. Now, the first stage, the off-site review, has just been completed, and this step requires that we demonstrate compliance with over 90 principles of accreditation. I'll pass this round, and you can get a flavor for the rich variety of principles, both in the academic, student affairs, physical facilities, financial audit, role of the board, etc., that these principles address. So there are over 90. There are 15 what are called core requirements and 11 federal requirements. And a university must pass all those 26 requirements for their accreditation to be reaffirmed. The other 70 or so are so-called comprehensive standards, which go into significantly deeper detail on many of the same elements. Now, demonstrating compliance in such a large array of topics requires a fair amount of explanation, and I assure you a massive amount of supporting documentation. The SACS leadership team, consisting of the president, myself, Dr. Miller, the SACS liaison, Dr. Sylvia Geico, Dr. Doug McElroy, Dr. Beth Lavis, Ms. Deb Wilkins, General Counsel, Kim Reed of the Budget Office, Tuesday Helbig, the Director of Institutional Research, Dr. Lauren Bland and Dr. Peggy Crow, and about another 50 or 60 people serving in various committees, worked diligently for months and months to assemble the compliance report, this, that equates to over 400 printed pages with nearly 5,000 links to supporting documentation. I say, while scores of individuals were involved in its creation and development, and I'd like these folks to stand up and be recognized as I announce them, I'd like to single out Beth Lavis, Sylvia Geico, Doug McElroy, Cindy Burnett, Rich Miller, and if she's still here, Nancy Major, for their outstanding assistance and their Herculean writing and editing efforts associated with getting the final compliance report submitted in September. I'd like to also thank Jessica Steenbergen from my office and Candace Tope Phillips, who couldn't be with us today, and the IT team, and I'll ask Gordon Johnson to stand and recognize on behalf of a large number of individuals, Greg Hackbarth, Amy Worth, Pat Johnson, and numerous others who provided outstanding assistance with the various technical issues involved. None of the off-site review team really called us at all to seek technical assistance because of the work of the IT division, and thanks, Gordon. Preliminary findings reported to SAC COC and then back to the campus just prior to Thanksgiving show that WKU was found to be in compliance with all 26 of the core and federal requirements and all but four of the remaining comprehensive standards. The four errors related to the following. One, samples of actual staff evaluations were not provided. Now, although we did over 1,400 staff evaluations in the year, we deliberately chose not to provide them because this was an open access website. And we will inform the committee, we'll be happy to show them redacted copies of actual staff evaluations when they visit in April. Number two, while appropriate qualifications for all of our library's personnel, faculty and staff were provided, the committee requested that we also provide corresponding position descriptions for those individuals, and we will do so. In the area of assessment, a wide array of student learning outcomes were addressed. However, we were requested to disaggregate these learning outcomes across campuses, main campus and our three regional campuses, and instructional delivery formats such as face-to-face, blended, and online. Comprehensive Standard 3.7.1 relates to faculty credentials for each and every course taught throughout the academic year. It's over 5,000 courses. This is the most common area cited by off-site reviewers. In our case, I'm pleased to note that questions were raised concerning faculty credentials for only 22 courses, representing less than 0.5% of all courses taught during the year. Three of our six colleges had zero credentialing issues for their courses. Thanks are due to a small army of student workers that assembled the thousands and thousands of pages of scanned transcripts and resumes to all of our faculty for providing documentation of their credentials and for defining appropriate credentials for each and every course taught, and to a group which became known as the Associate Dean Gang. Ken Crawford, Danita Kelly, Andrew McMichael, Jackie Pope-Terrence, Merrill Price, and Michelle Trawick for reviewing, refining, and honing what's called the faculty roster to its final 99-point-something% perfect state. We've already studied the 22 faculty members listed, and we're preparing our focused report response aimed at getting that number to 100% by the time the on-site committee arrives in April. So now I'd like to spend a few minutes highlighting some of the other findings of the committee, some of the things they said about the principles we were compliant with, because I think these statements are a resounding testament to the strength of our university and of its faculty, staff, and students. First, all sections related to the role and scope of the Board of Regents were found to be compliant and in some cases particularly well documented, close quotes. These sections were written by committee chair by General Counsel Deb Wilkins. Deb, you can relax now. It's okay. The report noted that the institutional assessment process is tied to a, quote, clear mission statement. They noted that recent revisions of the mission statement, as approved by the board in 2013, had improved alignment with the university's Challenging the Spirit strategic plan, and that multiple points of resource assessment and prioritization have allowed WKU to make mid-year shifts and to balance aspirational goals against financial realities based on data. I'd like to acknowledge the hard work of Doug McElroy, again, in spearheading the efforts related to the strategic plan, and to thank the Administrative Council, the Council of Academic Deans, and the University Senate for many important conversations and actions on matters relating to the development, assessment, and implementation of strategic priorities. The report favorably noted WKU's clearly articulated policy on policies, which, quote, ensures that the principles of good educational practices are incorporated. The committee also noted that time is allocated at new faculty orientation for a presentation about university policies and the faculty handbook in particular by the chair of the University Senate. I'd like to recognize Gordon Bayless for his pioneering work in establishing our policy on policies about 4 years ago. The report noted that WKU's academic programs all meet or exceed the minimum SAC-COC requirements. It further commented that there were, quote, clearly articulated processes for review and approval of academic programs, including, quote, documentation and minutes of committee meetings at all levels. I'd like to acknowledge the work of literally hundreds of our faculty on college committees, the university committee, curriculum committee, the graduate council, and the university senate, for their work in ensuring that WKU's academic programs are all worthy of the institution's high standards and that they stay up to date with the evolving state of knowledge in their disciplines. The committee noted very favorably that WKU's new general education program, the Colonnade program, had learning outcomes based on the national LEAP standards observed by the American Association of Colleges and Universities. I'd like to acknowledge Larry Snyder, if he's here, and the entire General Education Task Force, the Senate Colonnade Implementation Committee, for their efforts in assembling such an outstanding general education program that just started this fall, one that has lent itself very nicely, in fact, to the institution's new evidence and argument quality enhancement plan, and I'll pass those around. The report stated that WKU's continuing education, outreach, and service programs are consistent with the institution's mission to provide lifelong learning opportunities for all of its constituents and to enrich the quality of life for those within its reach. And here I'd like to acknowledge again the work of Beth Lavis and the DLO staff, Chief Information Officer Gordon Johnson, and his predecessor Bob Owen for maintaining such a high degree of effectiveness in WKU's distance learning offerings in such a rapidly changing arena of both technologies and consumer expectations. The report noted several ways in which the WKU Libraries ensures that library collections, resources, facilities, services, and staff are, across the board, not only adequate and sufficient, but also, in many cases, notable. And Dean Connie Foster from Libraries and the Libraries faculty and staff and the Campus Library Advisory Committee are to be commended for maintaining and constantly improving this essential resource for our faculty, staff, and students. The committee report noted that facilities are well managed by a department that is charged with the appropriate responsibility for providing a safe, clean environment to meet WKU's mission, and that 80% of faculty, staff, and students expressed that they were satisfied or extremely satisfied with those facilities. I'd like to thank Brian Russell and his predecessor, John Osborne, and their various teams for ensuring that the university's principal business of knowledge, acquisition, and sharing occurs in such a pleasant and work-friendly environment. The report noted that the Student Code of Conduct clearly outlines both the responsibilities of students and the due process afforded to students. It commented that the Division of Student Affairs has, quote, qualified professional and support staff with appropriate education or experience in the student affairs area, as well as significant years of experience. I'd like to acknowledge the efforts of the SGA, led by Nikki Taylor, Vice President Howard Bailey, and Peggy Crow of the Counseling and Testing Center in ensuring that our students enjoy a campus experience that is surely second to none. Last but not least for this group, the report noted that no management letter was issued in association with the university's most recent financial audit because, quote, the audit did not disclose any significant internal control weaknesses. Thanks are due to Senior Vice President Ann Mead and her team, including Budget Director Kim Reed, Chief Financial Officer Jim Cummings, and Accounting Financial Reporting Director Benji Harmon, for ensuring that, as the report succinctly stated, quote, WKU has adequate physical and financial resources to support its mission, close quote. And, of course, I'd like to thank you all, the Board of Regents, for your diligent attention to your fiduciary responsibilities to this university. Data distributed by SACS shows that the average number of compliance issues cited is 19.4, with a standard deviation of 7.8. And if you're that way inclined and curious, the skewness is 0.4 and the kurtosis is minus 0.3. The very low number of principals cited for further review therefore places WKU in that 2% tail of the distribution, in the top few percent of institutions seeking reaffirmation of accreditation. And in a recent teleconference with President Ransdell and members of the leadership team, SACS COC Vice President Robin Hoffman called the report, quote, one of the better compliance certification reports in my experience, close quotes, and an outstanding accomplishment. So kudos to the hundreds of people who contributed to this campus-wide effort. And while there is cause for significant satisfaction and a fair amount of relief, I must add, it's not quite over yet. We now have until early March to prepare and submit a focused report on these four remaining principles that I mentioned, finalize the development of our evidence and argument quality assessment enhancement plan, and await the arrival of the on-site review committee in April. Part of that visit will include a lunch with key members of the on-site committee and certain members of the board. We're very much looking forward to the visit. I hope you are too. And I hope they'll report on its outcome at the April board meeting next year. Thank you.
Quite a report.
That's all I have to say about that.
I think what is evident of what a team effort that is, and as a member of the board, I think all of us realize this happens once every 10 years, so not everyone will even be part of something. But for those of us that are on the board right now, and with that coming up, it is not just relief. It's really worth celebrating. Hopefully we'll have opportunities to do that over the next year.
Mr. Chairman, I've got two thoughts I'd like to add. First of all, he just completed the report, but our provost has been absolutely and abundantly diligent in pursuit of this effort and has taken it personal. He's taken it personal, and he himself has worked very hard, along with so many others across campus, to ensure that we had the report that you just had described. Well done, Gordon, to you as well. Now, this is an arduous process, but it's a critically important process, and it's one of those things that is also a enabler of self-esteem in an institutional setting. And higher education is different than most corporate enterprises, and this is a primary reason why. I know that private industry has their own standards that they have to meet to stay in business, but this is a pretty big deal in higher education. The second thought, the provost mentioned, there will be a luncheon when the on-site review team arrives in April, and I would suggest that the chair and the vice chair and the secretary participate in that luncheon to represent the board in the communication with the on-site committee. They don't expect the whole board to participate, but I think the officers would be appropriate to be part of that on-site review team luncheon, if you will.
I got the homework.
You see, you can thank me later for that opportunity. All right. But at any rate, that would be a logical group to represent the board with the on-site review committee, and they may have some questions, and they'll have comments, among us that may participate in that moment will be there to observe and let them have at it with you guys. And
Doesn't sound like a volunteer.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay, we have one more information item for you. You've noticed that your name badges, or name plates rather, are obscured by baskets with things in them. Gary's isn't. And keep up with the variety of agenda. I now introduce Dr. Ed Stevens from the chemistry department, who will give a presentation, and this I hope will make sense as he goes on, called Grand Rouge and Captain Marvel, Viticulture and Cassia Culture at the WKU Farm. Ed.
Yeah, controls and... I'll push it again. No.
Well, go forward.
Right.
Okay. All right. When the provost suggested the title for this, we're talking about making wine and making cheese. And so I understood the first part. Vin Grand Rouge is, of course, big, wet, red wine. But I didn't understand the Captain Marvel part. So I had to do a little digging on the internet, and Captain Marvel was an action hero that was very popular in comic books back in the 40s. He actually outsold Superman, and he of course had an arch enemy. Arch enemy referred to him as the Big Red Cheese, so that's the connection with cheese. Anyway, I'm going to talk a little bit about growing grapes and making wine, and also a little bit about making cheese. And this is all part of the one of the visions that the agriculture department has in finding ways for small farmers in Kentucky to increase their profitability by creating value-added products, finding ways of increasing the value associated with their agricultural products. And if we can turn milk into cheese, we can sell it for a higher price, or if we turn grapes into wine, we can also increase the value of that crop. I'm currently a scholar in residence here at Western Kentucky. I was on the faculty at the University of New Orleans for 32 years in the Department of Chemistry, and I'm currently in the Department of Chemistry here at WKU. To give you some brief background in my winemaking credentials, I'm currently enrolled in the Master of Winemaking Certificate program at the University of California, Davis, which is the leading school of enology and viticulture in the world. And I have two courses left to get that certificate. I'm also a wine reviewer. I've been in the top 100 of rankings in out of 6 million subscribers in the United States to the online and on and mobile app site, the Vino. And there's 20 million users of that in the world. Okay, well, to make wine, you have to have grapes, and WKU grows grapes on the farm. The vineyard has been in existence since 2008. We're going to write some students planting vines, and some of the mature vines in the corner right there. And there's a number of different varieties, American varieties, French hybrids, and European varieties that are now planted. Currently, most of the grapes are either sold locally or sold to vineyards in the area. And so one of the projects that I became involved in here when I came this fall was to see if we could start a program in winemaking. Here's what's been going on in viticulture, which is the science of growing wine. There are currently three courses that are taught. There are 15 different varieties and 5 different crossing systems that provide students with hands-on instruction in all of these aspects of growing grapes, and also provides a resource for actually investigating which grape varieties and viticultural practices are best suited for the local soil and climate of Southern Kentucky. And this project has been developed largely by Professor Todd Hoehn in the Department of Agriculture, and Ryan Phillips, who's here. He's a graduate student in agriculture and also a viticulture technician for the farm. And so we are investigating here the science of making wine once we have the grapes. Here is process involved. But first of all, the grapes are crushed, and this is a crusher that not only crushes the grapes, but also separates the stems from the grapes, and falling down in the bottom, in a trough in the bottom of this crusher, we get the crushed grapes. And left, we have some red varieties, and on the right, we have some white varieties. Of course, if we're going to eventually teach students how to make wine, we have to make sure that we can do it ourselves. So we started this this fall, and here is a picture of me pressing some of the grapes for white wine. The juice is separated immediately. And for the red wines, it is fermented in plastic buckets that are in the back there. And then after the fermentation is complete, the must is pressed and then transferred to these plastic jugs. These plastic jugs don't look very big, but each one of those holds the equivalent of about 30 bottles of wine, about 6 gallons. And in fact, even at the major research universities, this is the volume that is typically used when they do experiments, when they try and optimize the quality of the wine. They usually do it in small batches. This is, of course, much smaller than in the process that would take place in a commercial vineyard. But eventually then, after the fermentation is complete, the solids are allowed to settle out of the wine, and go through the process of racking the wine, which is transferring the liquid off of the top, and then eventually the wine is chilled and to further precipitate any solids that might eventually come out, and then filtered and put in bottles. So the little bottles that you have in your baskets there are the WKU wine that was made from grapes that grew on the farm. And it is suitable for human consumption.
It says for education only.
Yes. So the university is not a bonded winery, so we can't sell it, but we can use it for educational purposes. And currently, the university has been offering a course in wine fundamentals. This is a general course that covers all aspects of wine. Currently being taught as a special topics course, but it will eventually be Agriculture 323. It covers the history of wine, some basics on how to grow grapes, processes involved in making wine, and then a survey of the different wine styles around the world. And students who take this course will be given the opportunity to, as we're talking about wines from around the world, will also be given the opportunity to taste the wines. So in order to enroll in this, they have to be 21. And then next fall, we're proposing that we actually teach a course in wine production where students will have an opportunity to make the wine just in the same way that we saw there, we did this year. So that is our vision here. In the future, we could envision having a certificate of wine making, which could involve probably adding another course in chemistry and analysis of wine. And we had that in a viticulture course, and then say an elective, that would be 15 credit hours, suitable for a certificate. It also ties in with a number of other programs that the university has. There's a certificate in food technology, there's a certificate in food microbiology, there's a minor in food chemistry, and there's a number of courses that are offered in hospitality department. So it would all be suitable courses as electives for a certificate program. That's all I have to say about the wine, but in addition to that, our university is pursuing cheese making, and Ashley Egan is here. She's a graduate student in agriculture, and she has also received training in large-scale cheese production. And there are now facilities available for this. This is at the out on the farm in the Charles Taylor Agricultural Center building. The instrument on the left is a for making cheese. I think it holds 250 pounds of milk. Is that right? And on the right hand side, there's a walk-in cooler that can be used for storage and aging of cheeses as well. Ashley, do you have anything you want to add to this?
I just want to add a little bit from the student perspective and how this is going to benefit the students in the ag department and AMS, if even the marketing students. A lot of the students in the ag department come from a marketing background, not all of them, I do not. And a lot of their goals are to learn everything they can while they're here and get all the experience they can and take it back home and apply it to the farm and help their families go to the most of their farms grow. And that's our main goal with the Katie Kramer is to teach these students that just by creating a value-added product, cheese, it could be ice cream, it could be yogurt, specifically we're just doing cheese, and taking that back home and applying that, the dairy, the small family dairy can benefit from that. And you don't have to have 1,000-plus herd of cattle. You can just have 30 to 35 head of milking cow, which is what our dairy currently has at the farm right now. But you can prosper and you can go home.
Thank you.
Okay.
So that's all I have to say. I want to thank the head of the agriculture department, Jack Rudolph, who had the vision for starting these programs, and I want to thank Robert Dunn from the foil shop who prepared that.
When you say products, will there be, you said we cannot sell them now, is there the intent to eventually sell them through the floral shop or through the farm and its commodity production? I know we do sell milk, we sell other products on the farm. Is the intent to eventually be in a position to sell either the wine or the cheese or both?
We're in the Department of Agriculture is investigating the possibility of obtaining a license to be a winery, and that would then allow them to sell wine.
Do we know anybody that could possibly be involved in that process? I'm just curious.
Well,
I forgot this.
No, I mean, seriously, is there a time frame that you're on? I mean, this, I knew we were involved in this. I did not know some of the specifics, so it's good to learn. I knew we had a very nurse, so we have about 30. That produce, I know we sell milk, so how much of the milk produced by the herd is used for cheese production?
None of it currently. We are getting temporarily hooked up. Our equipment's on hooked up to it. Over Christmas break, it'll be temporary hooked up, and then they'll come in and inspect it electrically, share everything inside. And once that inspection is approved, then it'll be permanently hooked up. So I'm hoping by spring, we'll be in production.
I think a field trip to the farm might be in order for this board. So you need to meet these cows. They're wonderful.
Yeah. And once we are in production, the facility, the way it's set up, on this side of that cheese vat is a big window. And it is through the tables there. So people can come in as we're making the cheese and watch us and ask any questions. And students are going to be involved. They're going to be invited to come in and even before the classes are developed, they can come in and work with me and make the cheese.
I'm very serious about that from an academic affairs committee. These are two, relatively speaking, with what occurs on our university farm, it's a massive, complex operation that is very impressive from a number of commodities, from food production to animals. And we can rank that.
Count me in. Thank you very much for that presentation. And Mr. Chairman, that concludes the business of the
agenda. If you look at action item executive-1, that's a request for approval of the naming of the WKU Child Care Center as a Colleen B. Child Care Center. All of her outstanding background and service in securing grant funding for the training assistance, technical assistance department. Mansell, do you have any other comments on this?
All the individuals involved in this university who have been engaged in grant writing, grant production, and success, no one has excelled at the level of Colleen Mendo and what she has built with our training and technical assistance program, our Head Start and Early Head Start programs. There was a period of about 10 years, and Dr. Birch will know well, when she was met with Rainmakers for federal support for these programs, and in fact rose to the level where we were the premier Head Start, Early Head Start program in the southeastern United States. And it still is a terrific program. Unfortunately, we lost Colleen about a year ago, and it would be most appropriate for this naming opportunity to be approved recognize her legacy with these programs. And Barbara, you may have some additional thoughts to share.
I couldn't agree more, and I'm sure Dean Evans could add more information. But Western, at one point, probably was known as well as any other institution in the country in terms of training teachers for Head Start programs and its innovative work in childhood education. And I think Colleen is not only a master grantswoman, but she was very visionary in what could be done. She never lost her touch, but somewhere along the way, the federal government decided that it might be better to sort of create subcontracting and do this in a different way. And so the grant opportunities were very finished. But she never stopped. She trained more people across the country in this area, and I think I can't think of anyone that would be worth fitting to honor.
Sam, in that round number, what was the combined total volume of grants that Colleen Mendo was responsible for generating for WKU?
It exceeded $100 million. Yeah. I would say it's either 102, 109 in that range. There were two, and there still are two aspects of GKAS here at WKU. WKU Child Care Center, which is in Jones-Jaggers, and then we've got the grant side in terms of a lot of training for individuals across the United States, and there's also a business venture tied in with it where the consultants go out. They provide services to a number of Head Start programs, and I was just reading a piece earlier this morning. We're in line for significant grant, I hope, from my home state of Missouri to provide services in that area. They are nationally known in terms of their work, and there's probably no one entity in the United States, no one person who has impacted Head Start programs any more than Colleen. She did a significant job. Tremendous credibility for the work with KU. It was not only a pleasure to know and work with her, but this is a way for her legacy to be maintained at KU across the United States.
I remember during my first couple of weeks on the job, I was invited to an announcement of one of Colleen's grants, and it was for over $10 million. And I was impressed. That's okay.
That is impressive.
Well, as you see, President Mansfield recommends that the Board of Regents accept the naming of the WKU Child Care Center as the Colin G. Mendel Child Care Center.
Second.
All in favor?
I have a question.
I'm sorry, you had a question?
Yeah.
Okay.
The question is motions on the floor. As a policy board, is this then the procedure that when there is a naming opportunity for a building that comes before this board? Because in the past, in this building itself, there was some question about whether it could be named or name changed, and here we are once again being approached about naming a facility. I support this motion 100%, but just as a point of order, I'm a little confused about how that operates. So I've requested some time ago for us to address that, but it just seems to me that there are times, and maybe it's just that my lack of knowledge or education on the subject, but there are times when we participate in the naming and times we don't participate in the names or the changing of names. So I just want to be sure that this board is following whatever policy is out there. We follow the same policy consistently. That's my question.
I cannot think of a time when the board hadn't approved the board policy when a facility that's unnamed is named, this board approves that.
Okay. So it's just when there is a name that is to be new, right? Any changes then, that's left up to other procedures.
Well, if a change requires a change, there's never been a time when an individual's name has been taken to change to take an off the building. I would say if there's ever a reason to take an individual's name off the building, that this board would approve that.
If the board approves it, I mean, if
that
board
really is my question. That's really not my question. My question is, are we involved in only naming, or are we responsible for naming the building complete? So, because
No, but we buildings get different names for them all the time. Departments change, department names change. That is a very frequent activity on the university campus. So, no, we have not brought to the board when building naming other than individuals occurs. That's a very common practice when you think about the complexities of all the buildings and all the departments and all the rooms across campus. So the board policy calls for approval of individuals' names when names are applied to a building.
Sorry. Just again, so I have a clear understanding. If Gordon Ford, what is the North Wing called? It's Wilson, Gordon Wilson Hall or something?
The North Wing.
Wing of Thompson Complex. Isn't that called?
No, it's the North Wing.
All right, then pick a different, let's say Van Meter Hall, for example. If that decided one day to be the agricultural department, it would still be Van Meter, and it could be Van Meter Agricultural Department.
Because it's named for an individual. If there was a change in the individual's designation, then that would come before the board.
So you could change the department.
You could,
yes,
the
scope of the building could change, the
Van Meter, and that would not likely come before the board.
So later on, if this association is with her honors and her dedication with child care development, then in 20 years, someone can come back and say, this is still Coley and Mendel building, but it's not the
child. Well, actually, the child care center is what's being named. That center could be named somewhere else and still bear her name.
I see.
This is the center, not the building.
Okay.
It's in Jones Jagger's building. This is the center.
Got it.
Within the building.
I support this one. Just I was asking for clarification how it all works.
Motion. Ready? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes. Next, I'll call on Catherine Costello for the alumni relation highlights and performance of the board.
Since your appetite has been great,
It's really helpful. I love the color coding on the cabinet. How difficult is it to get a sense of the purposes for which the giving is designated? Like how much goes to scholarship, how much of it is open? And I'm asking particularly with the notion of scholarship giving. But there would be other scholarship money that wasn't designated. I was just really, I'm asking mostly because as I realized the hugely increasing need for scholarships, I think it would be really interesting and valuable to have a sense of just where we are.
Every member of the development team works on scholarships.
I think it's
Call Brian Rumble to go to Thompson Complex also.
Well, I'm excited to tell you that we're going to be back in the raising of the Thompson Complex. We have budgeted $1 million. We had received $1.3 million from the reserve fund. Decommissioning of the building, taking all the trees out of the building, getting it ready. And now the five bids from TES, complete demolition services out of Louisville, Kentucky. We've got them bonded, we've got them under contract. They actually started today, unloading dumpster equipment and actually starting to do products. We will have demolition, the building will be gone before the start of school this next semester. And grand total, we're under that $1 million budget number that we had, which is exciting. And that's all come out of the office, managed by Ben Johnson. Good news report is that we're under budget and on that. So, any questions?
Refresh on probably what happens next.
All right, well, concurrently, you're working with Dr. Stevens, who has left our Avery building, but we've been working with them doing programming for a new facility. So go back in that location. They're working with Ross Arndt Architects. The original budget for the building is $48 million for the project, I won't say just the building. And that process will move forward into schematic documents, and then we'll go construction documents, and then we'll go out for bid. The bid process for the project will be in November. That's where we'll award the bid to the contractor. And then we have plans on having the new facility, the new science facility, completed by, I think it's June of 2017. And then we'll be doing renovation as well. And currently in that same process, the Thompson Complex Center Wing, which will be focusing on the infrastructure, roofing, heat and air,
and I probably should know, I'm sorry, I just get her, but our funding source for that, we have multiple.
Funding source for
state programs.
That's all state.
From the state.
So there's no more federal partnership or anything.
Zero.
In that building, okay.
Does the 48 include the Thompson North, Center Wing?
Yes.
That 48 was part of all
that. That's part of the project, but it is not a 100% renovation of Thompson Complex.
What is the approximate ratio of the 48 million to a new North Wing building and a
right now
basic improvements in the center?
$6 million in our budget for the Thompson Complex. So.
And how near will that come to what you really need to do there?
Well, it will take the infrastructure of the building to make it whole. Again, we're early in the design. We're in the programming part. We'll sit back down, talk to all, it's been a lot of years since we originally programmed and went forward with that initial information, working with the teams and the people that are current because our programs have changed, so we'll get that nailed down, and then they'll take that information to the new building, and we'll, it's a chess game of how we'll move the pieces to the people, so we're in that process. Planning stage to early stages.
Questions for Brian? Any other, we got a lot of projects in a given time, and we've focusing on this particular project now, but any other questions for Brian? That's not a question for Brian.
That's a good shot.
The proud canine at my feet is Lady, Regent Higdon's marvelous and impressive dog, who's an English Cocker Spaniel, Phil Bread.
Yeah, Freddie dragged me out about 2 weeks ago.
The question is, did he really shoot that?
He did. That was his first bird.
Oh, my dear brother.
And then the new shot was I told him that his shooting first bird was supposed to have the head off and win the head
off. He survived that. I wasn't on the agenda, but that's all right. The next board meeting is set for January 23. Do they have this sheet that shows?
Yeah, they gave it to me at the October meeting, but I can send it
back. Yeah, so put that back around. Yes, January 23. Back at the Martin Regents room, but seriously, if you'd like to look, plan. Maybe the spring or the summer meeting at the University of Durham.
You won't make it in the winter.
That concludes everything on the agenda.
Please,
everybody, happy holiday season.